The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another episode of Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic, The Washington Post, and The New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Well, if you were with us in our previous episode of Armchair Traveler, you will recall that we featured in part The Road to 2070 from the April 2020 issue of National Geographic. Writer Craig Welch and his photographer traveling companion David Guttenfelder shared their cross-country journey aboard electric cars. They began last fall at the Santa Monica Pier in California, where the famed Route 66 stretches 2,200 miles to Chicago. They chose the Santa Monica Pier as the starting point for their cross-country road trip in electric cars. Historically, as Welch pointed out, the first ever cross-country journey using a motorized vehicle took place over 63 days in 1903. Physician Horatio Jackson drove from San Francisco to New York to win a $50 bet that he couldn't make the drive. He did it with a companion, an adopted bulldog named Bud, who wore specially fit goggles to protect his eyes. Today, Dr. Jackson's vehicle, a 20-horsepower Winton touring carriage, is on display at the National Museum of History in Washington, D.C. Our journey last time covered a variety of sites where research and testing are underway to help America to become less dependent on fossil fuels, replacing them with power generated by solar panels and wind turbines. Ironically, the most wind-generated site in the country is located in Texas, where the electricity fuels pumps designed to capture newly discovered oil deposits for the continued and growing consumer demand for fossil fuel. Even though there has been tremendous growth in renewable and clean energy, consumers continue to favor vehicles powered by internal combustion engines. The top choice are SUVs. Still, according to Welch, renewable energy, predominantly wind and solar, is projected to eclipse all other sources of energy by 2045, largely due to state mandates and falling cost. The U.S. government is forecasting the renewable contribution to U.S. electricity will rise from 19% to 38% by 2050, a figure that falls short of current climate targets. When we stopped on our journey last time, Welch was showing us how a former Maytag washing machine factory was now forging wind turbine parts in the small town of Newton, Iowa. He noted that in the next couple of years, the furnaces used to forge the steel turbine parts will be powered entirely by clean energy, eliminating the need for coke-fired electric arc furnaces. Today, on Armchair Traveler, we resume our journey in Michigan, where Craig Welch and David Guttenfelder encounter yet another entrepreneur whose dream is to create electric-powered cars and trucks that can travel well beyond today's expectations. And so let us resume our journey. As a student at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Robert R.J. Scaringe strung clotheslines in his apartment and did other time-consuming and challenging things to minimize his carbon footprint. Urging people to forfeit modern conveniences, he determined wasn't a winning strategy. It's too hard, he told us. Today, Scaringe runs electric vehicle startup Rivian, which plans to release a sport utility vehicle and a pickup this year. It also has a deal with retail giant Amazon to build 100,000 electric delivery trucks by 2030. What's true of renewables is also true of electric vehicles. Things are changing fast, just not fast enough. Globally, there are 5 million electric cars, an increase of nearly 2 million in 1 year. Volkswagen alone plans to build 26 million more in 10 years, but that's in a world of roughly 1.5 billion cars and trucks. EVs are just 2% of the U.S. market. Tesla isn't the only company trying to make EVs cooler. Ford has unveiled an electric Mustang, Harley-Davidson, an electric motorcycle. But worldwide, drivers are favoring heavy, more polluting SUVs. There are now more than 200 million on the road, six times as many as in 2010. Skaringe is aiming for that market. At Rivian's Plymouth, Michigan engineering and design plant, we watched workers zip about on skateboards. Skaringe, 37, is focused on vehicles for active outdoor lifestyles. He plans with partners to build high-speed charging stations in less-traveled places, near the edge of the trail, as he puts it. Much as teenagers can't imagine life before social media, Skaringe expects his own children, all under age 5, will never know a world where charging wasn't ubiquitous. Over the next few days, Guttenfelder and I race toward our destination, Washington, D.C. We stopped in Ohio to tour First Solar, the biggest U.S. manufacturer of solar panels. In Pennsylvania, we drove past Three Mile Island Nuclear Plant. 40 years after the notorious accident that shut down its first reactor, the other one had just closed as well because it is too expensive to run today. 7 other American nukes have shut down since 2013. 7 more plan to do so by 2025. Much of their carbon-free electricity will be replaced by emissions-rich natural gas. The debate about the future of nuclear is complex and increasingly ideological. So is the debate around climate change. Unfortunately, for reasons that are hard to understand, sustainability has become a very political issue, Skaringe told me. Yet policy shifts at all levels of government are needed to speed our transition to clean energy. Can a polarized nation be brought together around solutions? Days before starting our trip, I'd visited a man who'd run for president proposing to do just that. On an afternoon when CNN was hosting town halls on climate with Democratic candidates, I'd driven a Nissan Leaf south from my Seattle home to Olympia, the state capital, to meet Washington Governor Jay Inslee. Inslee had mapped out plans for everything, from a national renewable energy policy for utilities to a zero-carbon building standard. But his presidential campaign never caught on, and he'd recently ended it. Seemingly unbowed, he told me a story about the nation's ability to move quickly when the will is there. In 1940, the U.S. Army asked automakers to make or design a brand-new light reconnaissance vehicle. By the end of World War II, 5 years later, workers had built nearly 645,000 Jeeps. "We are in a movie where we have not seen the final reel," Inslee said, "and we have the capability of having this be a happy ending." A month after leaving Santa Monica, Guttenberg and I arrived in Washington. Ducking into the National Museum of American History, I spotted Horatio Jackson's red Wenton carriage, complete with a replica of Bud the Bulldog in goggles. The exhibit, about American road trips, also highlighted an arduous 1919 cross-country convoy of military vehicles that had included a young lieutenant colonel, Dwight Eisenhower. Later as president, Eisenhower would champion the interstate highway system. A display nearby traced the history of how highways became necessary. Within a quarter century of Jackson's journey, cars had become a fixture of American life. 23 million roamed the U.S. by 1930 as Route 66 was being paved. More than half of American families owned one, maybe even some who'd initially dismissed them as devil wagons. Americans adapt quickly once convinced that change is necessary, even useful. It could happen again. By 2070, clouds of rolling coal might be barely remembered wisp on the wind. Earlier in his article, Craig Welch states that one of the factors slowing electric car usage was the limited number of charging stations. Tesla boasts only 750 proprietary supercharger stations in the U.S., while also operating some 3,800 slower charging stations. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, there are 78,301 charging stations now available throughout the U.S., and most are slow charging, meaning you'll have to wait in order to get on the road again. There's also a rule of thumb electric car users need to consider: know how far you can go before you need to recharge, and also know where the nearest recharging site might be. Keep in mind that hills and rugged terrain take more energy, so you may not be able to cover all the miles claimed for a normal fully charged vehicle. A good example is Welch's experience, which he explained when he plugged in his Hyundai Kona and saw a message on the dash: charging will take 6 hours. He and Guttenfelder then had to walk a mile to the nearest motel. Well, the race for renewable, clean, and sustainable energy is only part of today's travel climate. There's also the ongoing impact of COVID-19, as we have featured in some previous episodes of Armchair Travel. Writer Hugh Bigger's article, Halt in Ecotourism Threatens Conservation Efforts Worldwide. This appeared in the June 11th, 2020 issue of the Washington Post. In northern Cambodia, giant ibis, white-winged ducks, and other rare species have helped ecotourism take flight in recent years. Just two decades after their near extinction, the population of giant ibis has grown to about 300 birds, bringing in thousands of visitors to remote areas of the country. This tourism has provided an important economic catalyst, generating critical revenue for rural communities and conservation initiatives. But now in Cambodia and other wild places around the world, ecotourism is in the crosshairs of a new threat, COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus. The consequences for both wildlife and people are still unfolding and expected to be far-reaching. A major source of income for rural communities has suddenly been cut off, said Jeremy Radanchowski, a director of the Mesoamerica and Western Caribbean Program for the Wildlife Conservation Society. It's going to have an especially large impact on budgets for protected areas and wildlife, which also happen to be some of the most important investments we can make to avoid future pandemics, he said. What's it like to go on vacation during a pandemic? Well, I went to a newly reopened resort to find out. Why? Because, he said, degradation of natural ecosystems and wildlife trafficking facilitate the spillover and spread of zoonotic diseases. Or, as the World Economic Forum website puts it, it is no coincidence that the destruction of ecosystems has coincided with a sharp increase in infectious diseases. Added Midori Paxton, head of Ecosystems and Biodiversity at the United Nations Development Program, intact nature gives us air, water, and food and serves as a natural vaccine to reduce the frequency and intensity of future outbreaks. Since the outbreak of the coronavirus, investments in nature are in jeopardy as resources are diverted and tourism dollars supporting conservation dwindle. Most world travel destinations have experienced shutdowns as borders have been shut, visas restricted, and quarantines enforced to limit the spread of the virus. National parks, game preserves, and wildlife sanctuaries in Africa, Asia, and beyond have closed. The closures have led to reduced protection for wildlife and lost incomes as rangers, guides, drivers, cooks, animal caregivers, and others have been let go. The UN World Tourism Organization estimates a decline of international tourism of 60-80% by the end of the year compared with 2019, with trillions of dollars and millions of jobs lost. The biggest concern in the short term is continued investment in ecotourism in rural areas to make up for lost revenue streams and jobs, said Johan Robinson of the UN Environment Program, also called UNEP, UNEP, noting that the global cutbacks due to COVID-19 could last a year or more. The collapsed tourism industry adds new stressors on top of ongoing challenges from vanishing habitats to climate change to human encroachment. Already, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, or IUCN, and the UN Development Program have reported an increase in natural resources exploitation and illegal killings of wild animals and threatened species. In Costa Rica, a new ecotourism initiative to help conserve the once common white-lipped peccary, similar to a wild boar, has seen few visitors. Meanwhile, the white-lipped peccaries are increasingly endangered due to hunting of the large animals and deforestation. In Namibia, a cheetah conservation center can no longer rely on tourist visits to help fund operations. In Gabon, in March, the government closed its grape ape parks to tourists due to COVID-19, as have other African countries. The closures have drained funds from efforts to protect critically endangered gorillas and other great apes. In Sumatra, ecologists can't provide their usual support to a sanctuary for nearly extinct Sumatran rhinos and nearby elephant hospitals. In the wading pools, swamps, marshes, and rainforests of northern Cambodia, tourists used to visit in hopes of catching sight of the critically endangered giant ibis, characterized by their height and silver-tipped wings notched with black crossbars and other wildlife. Their visits have generated thousands of dollars for community funds and conservation programs, according to the Wildlife Conservation Society. But now the local economy is in limbo, and this spring the group reported that several giant ibis were killed for their meat, as were white-winged ducks, painted storks, and other wild animals. International agencies and organizations are scrambling to respond to the crisis and reduce incentives to hunt, poach, and illegally clear land for farming, timber, or other resources. Wide-scale socioeconomic stress related to COVID-19 has added to the pressure, with the World Food Program estimating millions of people worldwide are now living close to starvation and resorting to whatever options are available to survive. If the supply of money from tourism dries up, rangers might be laid off, leave the bush, and look for other ways to feed their families, says Chris Thallis, Director of Research for Save the Elephants. If someone sees an elephant, for instance, they might shoot it as an investment, even if they cannot immediately get money for the tusk, and hunting for bushmeat may increase, he added. Across Africa, with many countries dependent on wildlife tourism industry that brings in billions of dollars, the outlook is equally grim. The situation is pretty bad, UNEP's Robinson said. Most of the parks have been closed, and there are no tourists and no safaris. It's a huge loss of income, and lots of lodges don't know if they're going to make it. Similarly, across Central and South America, conservationists are seeing increases in deforestation, poaching, and sudden disruptions to long-established businesses and ways of life. In Ecuador, the wildlife-rich Galapagos Islands have had few visitors this spring, and the tourist-based economy has seen thousands of jobs lost. In response, organizations are ramping up support. The Lion's Share nonprofit, for example, is awarding small grants to ecotourism-dependent communities in developing countries. Other groups are tapping reserves and emergency funds to keep employees on the payroll and ensure staff and partners in the field have food, water, and other supplies. Continued international cooperation and global support for conservation is also seen as vital, including such programs as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Rhinoceros and Tiger Conservation Program, as government priorities are diverted by the crisis. Funding from governments and existing private sector is not going to be enough, Robinson said. Estimates already indicated that more than double the pre-COVID government and philanthropic investments were needed for effective global conservation. Experts also say this is a good opportunity to revisit some of the deleterious effects of tourism and consider new approaches. For ecotourism, drawbacks can include overcrowding of fragile ecosystems, overdevelopment of tourist amenities, and pollution. Long flights to far-flung destinations also emit tons of carbon linked to global warming. To offset some of these impacts, some organizations are considering investing more in economic alternatives to ecotourism. Governments that have defaulted on properly financing protected areas too easily rely solely on tourism revenue to make up the difference, said Trevor Sandwith, director of IUCN's Global Protected Areas Program. This reliance has exposed these areas to a funding crunch that coincides with the pandemic and is caused by it. It has the very serious knock-on effect of affecting the livelihoods of local communities and increasing pressure on protected areas, he said. In response, alternatives to ecotourism are gaining popularity while sharing the goal of protecting nature and supporting local economies. Among those are conservation trust funds, debt for nature swaps, biodiversity offsets, tax incentives, and green and blue bonds, debt instruments to raise capital for ecological purposes. In one example, 2 years ago, the Seychelles, a scenic vacation spot in the Indian Ocean, diversified its tourism-dependent economy by raising $15 million through a blue bond to protect the marine life that helps bring in tourists. And as travel slowly resumes, as quarantines and lockdowns are lifted, ecotourism will also find its place again in the post-pandemic world. Travel is important for all sorts of reasons, and ecotourism essential to this, said Joe Walston, Vice President for Field Conservation at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Hopefully, people will also recognize All of these environmental issues are related to each other, he added, and will take fewer trips but spend more time in the places they visit. He went on to say, in the short term, we must do what we can do to see that rural communities and wildlife survive. By the way, Bigger is based in Washington, D.C., and if you'd like to follow how he covers travel issues, you can catch him at Instagram at Hugh Bigger, H-U-G-H-B-U-G-G-A-R, Hugh Bigger, a writer for the Washington Post. Well, you may have heard that wearing masks is now required for people who fly. In fact, we've had a lot of stories about masks in the past few days. They're now required, for example, in Wake County, along with Durham and Orange counties. But a recent article by Tariro Imzawa carries this headline. Airlines say everybody on board must wear a mask. So why aren't they? Her article's from the June 4th, 2020 issue of the New York Times. So let's find out what she has learned. As airlines try to convince Americans to fly again, they have touted their policies for keeping passengers safe, including the requirement that everyone on board wear a mask. But travelers on recent flights said the rules are not being enforced, and flight attendants said they have been told not to confront passengers who opt not to follow them. Now, let me put in a disclaimer right here. This article, again, written on June 4th, and in recent days, a couple of airlines have announced they are going to crack down on this. So there are some changes already in the works as I read this article. So you need to check in with your airline if you're flying to find out more. But this is give you a perspective time-wise, written just a few days before these two airlines that I recall, United being one, I believe American the other, that, you know, they are going to enforce these. So just keep that in mind. We continue. Drusilla Lawton flew from South Carolina to Wyoming in May on two American Airlines flights and said the mask rule wasn't being enforced during boarding or on the plane. I was just horrified watching the gate agent let people through without their masks, said Miss Lawton, a part-time portfolio manager. When I was walking down the aisle, I was wondering how many people aren't wearing a mask. There were so many. Miss Lawton said the first leg of the trip was particularly bad, and the people across the aisle from her, those in front of her and those behind her, did not wear a mask. Although the woman sitting next to her put on a mask after Miss Lawton asked her to, there was never an announcement from the flight crew or captain about the rules. On social media and in emails to the Times, other travelers described similar scenarios, which left them feeling they had to choose between confronting fellow passengers and possibly encountering hostility and sitting on a flight for hours, potentially being exposed to the coronavirus. The patchwork enforcement of policies has left passengers uncomfortable, confused about whether they should be wearing masks or not, and concerned about their safety. They've also left flight attendants with the difficult task of trying to make people do something they won't be punished for if they choose not to comply. Airlines have said, follow the guidelines, but don't enforce them. Don't tackle people to the ground, and don't turn flights around if they don't listen, said Sarah Nelson, president of the Association of Flight Attendants Union. That gets around to the public, then it's, I don't have to do this. There are no consequences if I don't do this. That, too, can lead to conflict, not just with the flight attendants, but with other passengers who get angry, and all of a sudden we have to break up a fight. Well, just to follow up with yet another disclaimer to add, since this story was written originally on June 4th, these airlines that I mentioned earlier that are going to crack down are going to create a travel list so you can be on a do not let them fly list if you don't comply. So just let you know there are some enforcement consequences coming up. Now, recent passengers on Delta Airlines have posted on Twitter about flyers failing to wear masks. What's the point in requiring if there's no follow-through, one man asked the airline in a tweet. Another Delta passenger wrote on Twitter he asked a flight attendant about the mask rule after seeing a passenger, a flight attendant, and the pilot without mask on. He was told that the rules couldn't be enforced. And after one doctor's Twitter post about the lack of social distancing on a United Airlines flight went viral, another United traveler said she had to ask the gate agent to put on a mask before getting on a full flight to Chicago from New Jersey. If you're traveling right now, be prepared to advocate for yourself, she wrote, adding that United did not follow their own social distancing guidelines and many travelers were not wearing masks. Nicole Kierer, a spokeswoman for United, said that face coverings are mandatory for all employees and passengers on board, and the airline is providing free masks to customers who need them. In instances where people refuse to wear a mask, they can be pulled aside to further understand their concerns and discuss options, Ms. Kierer said. This would include things like moving them to a new seat where they could maintain a safe social distance from other passengers. Denying someone boarding would be a last resort, she said. Ames Coney, 65, recently flew from Missoula, Montana to Boston with his wife. When the boarding group for their second flight on American was called, people gathered close together, causing him some anxiety about the lack of social distancing, Mr. Coney, who is known as Andy, said in a phone interview. The crew made no effort to ask passengers to wear their masks properly and even joked about the rule with an obnoxious guy across from us with his mask under his chin, who seemed to be enjoying making everyone else uncomfortable, he said. Mr. Coney said he and his wife were also particularly concerned about people traveling without masks because the two of them are in the over 65 vulnerable group and had been deferring their return home to Massachusetts since mid-March. They only decided to fly home after American announced its social distancing rules and safety measures. Typically, when an event as major as the coronavirus is involved, government agencies, including the Federal Aviation Administration, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Labor, and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, have come together with airlines, unions, and other stakeholders to create policies and emergency procedures to help travelers and transportation staff, said Ms. Nelson of the Flight Attendants Union. But since the coronavirus pandemic began, no such coordination has taken place, and that's left the airlines to set their own rules and their own standards of enforcement. In normal times, something like this calls for a federal response, but we don't have it, Ms. Nelson said. In an event like 9/11, things were incredibly transparent. There were emergency procedures put in place. None of that is happening now. We don't have consistent rules, so the airlines are trying to figure out how to navigate this. Last month, Reuters reported that the three airlines instructed their employees not to enforce the rules that have been promoted to travelers. Once on board and off the gate, the face covering policy becomes more lenient, American said to its staff in an email that was quoted in the Reuters report. The flight attendant's role is informational, not enforcement, with respect to face covering policy, the report noted. Ms. Nelson said that one concern for flight attendants has been about what happens if there is a confrontation with a passenger who is asked to wear a mask but doesn't want to. Now, Tony Scott, who is also a marketing executive, age 53, lives in Los Angeles. He booked a first-class ticket on an airline, expecting that with social distancing policies, he would have adequate space. But the passenger next to him, a teenage girl, refused to wear a mask. When he talked to the flight attendant, he was told masks are optional, even though the American app said otherwise. The flight attendant later told Mr. Scott the masks were mandatory, but not for children. And that was a 16 to 17-year-old Caucasian girl, Mr. Scott wrote in his Twitter message. I explained that I'm in the high-risk category as an African-American male with asthma and other health issues. And he said no other accommodation was offered. So there you go, some stories about flying and about the mask. Now, those are going to change dramatically, according to recent reports, as I said. So check with your airline, because they are cracking down, and I think these stories will be something of the past. But they did happen in recent flights over the past 60 to 90 days, just so you know, okay? And that's going to bring us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.